I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to She Started It, the podcast that explores female entrepreneurship through the eyes of an inspiring guest every week. I'm your host, Angelica Malin, editor-in-chief of About Time magazine and founder of the She Started It Live Festivals. From fashion to fitness, law to entrepreneurship, this series of She Started It will explore what it takes to be a female trailblazer today. Get ready to be totally inspired. Today's podcast is brought to you in partnership with Tide. Tide is the business current account designed to support small business owners like you. With no daunting paperwork and no monthly fees, you could open an account in minutes. They couldn't make it simpler. Trusted by over 100,000 businesses. Download the Tide app to get started today. Ellie Flynn is an investigative journalist and presenter who's made a number of documentaries for BBC Three. Ellie's debut documentary series, Ellie Undercover, saw her expose crimes and injustices against other people her age in the UK. In the first episode, Ellie looked at cases of rent for sex, where landlords offered free rooms in properties in exchange for sexual favours. The second episode, The Botox Bust, saw Ellie on the trail of medics who may be wrongly providing Botox. Ellie's most recent undercover documentary sees her investigate two multi-level marketing companies. Aside from her undercover series, Ellie's also made documentaries for BBC Three on Ireland's abortion referendum, the issue of so-called fake homelessness and child marriage in the USA. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me in your own words about the work that you do?
So I make documentaries, current affairs stuff, do a lot of undercover, predominantly for BBC Three. And I've covered all sorts of different topics, but generally seems to be things that target a young audience. So issues that really affect young people in the world today. A lot of the stuff I do is UK-based, and a lot of it is stuff that affects women in particular.
Where did the desire come from to do this kind of work and to go into investigative journalism?
So I studied journalism after I left uni for a year, and originally I was looking at trying to do magazines, and then sort of found more and more of an interest in investigative stuff. That seemed to be what I kind of was always drawn towards. So I sort of found this interest in investigative journalism, did a bit of freelance writing, and then I actually worked at a newspaper for a little bit and would do more and more investigations here and there, did a little bit of undercover, and then fell into documentaries by chance, really. But it feels like the best place to try and do these kind of investigations. You get a lot more time, you get a lot more room to really look into things.
What kind of skill set do you think you need to do investigations?
I think you have to be really inquisitive, fundamentally. I think you have to just want answers to questions and think about how you're going to get them. That was the main reason I really wanted to get into journalism, actually. I was just really nosy as a kid and growing up, and I wanted to ask questions. I always wanted to find out more about things, and I couldn't just let things lie. And I think that transfers quite well into journalism, particularly investigative journalism.
The topics that you've covered in some of your documentaries have been really hard hitting. Can you kind of talk to me about what that experience has been like and kind of how you deal with it on a personal level as well?
Yeah, it is. It is tough sometimes. I mean, I think specifically because you become so immersed in these worlds, and you'll be looking at an issue for, you know, however long it might be, a couple of months to 6 months. I think the longest investigation I've done has run over almost a year now. And it can be quite difficult to take yourself away from it, especially when you come back from filming and you've become so immersed in this issue and so immersed in people's lives, and you're hearing these really, really tragic stories. It's quite difficult sometimes to take a step back and to sort of think about it as a job, and you're there to report on something impartially. You can end up getting a bit of an emotional connection to things, and that's quite tough.
Do you find it kind of takes you out of your own life in a way? I can kind of imagine going to like the pub with friends or something in the evening, and you've been working on something really hard-hitting and difficult during the day that I'm not sure my mind would be fully present.
Yeah, it's weird. I definitely segregate my home life and my work life massively. So when I'm on a shoot, when I'm working on a documentary, if I'm away, I won't really think about my home life at all. And then I come home and I am quite good at separating work from that. But I have noticed I'm just so intense at parties now because everyone's like, oh, what are you up to? And I'm like, oh, well, I've been doing this undercover investigation and then I'm covering this story and it's all really heavy topics and people are interested, so they ask more. And I'm like, I've been standing in the corner talking about the most intense subjects for the past 45 minutes. Like, honestly, stop inviting me.
Do you ever feel like just making up a totally fake job? Like, I'm just, yeah. I'm a lifeguard.
Yeah, a lifeguard. I work in a zoo, something like that.
What for you have been the hardest ones that you've done?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think the one that I'm working on at the moment, it's due to come out. Actually, I'm not sure. It might have already come out by the time that this goes out. But my most recent one for BBC Three is about sexual assault in police custody in the US. And that's been, I've been working on it over the course of a year. And we've, you know, it's been really difficult finding people. Obviously, getting people to open up about something that's so, so horrific. Mm-hmm. And then also, It's just been a really tough one because it's such a emotive subject. It's really difficult to get people to open up about it. And obviously you have to be so sensitive when you're speaking to people about what they've been through. And then just in terms of the issue itself, more and more people are saying that police officers are sexually assaulting people in America, but there's no place that you can go to. There's no place with figures or statistics, and all of the police forces in America are so segregated. There's no one on like a government level or a federal level that's collating this evidence. So just in terms of actually looking into the issue and finding out how much is this happening, how bad is this issue, has taken a year and was really difficult in itself. Mm. So it's just a tough investigation.
And I suppose no one really trains you in that sensitivity and trying to get the best out of people and make them feel safe and open up to you. There's no training you can really do for that.
No, there's not. It is just something that you learn on the ground. And it's something that I'm still learning. I feel like I've learned so much over the past, it's been about a year and a half now since I've started working in documentaries. And I've seen how much I've grown in that time, and I've seen how much my interview style has changed and developed. And it is, you know, you do make mistakes, and sometimes you feel like you've said the wrong thing, and you'll come back, and sometimes I'll finish a shoot and I'll say, oh God, I can't believe I didn't ask that, or I didn't deal with this in that way. And I think it's quite easy to be quite hard on yourself, but like you say, it isn't something you can really train yourself to do. So
what are some of the challenges of like the nature of your job? So obviously it's freelance, you're kind of having to be self-employed, you're having to come up with the ideas. I guess there are some barriers with that as well.
Yeah, it's, I think being freelance is just difficult for anyone sometimes. My personality as well, I almost think I quite need structure and I quite like having structure. So it's been quite difficult for me to balance how I can manage my time and how to sort of make it work as a freelancer. So that's been a whole learning curve in itself. And other challenges, I think everyone expects things to move a lot quicker than it does. TV takes ages. It takes ages from the point of having an idea, pitching an idea, to then starting production and finishing production. Mm. And it's good in a way because it means you have loads of time to think about this story and this issue. But it also can be quite frustrating at times, and particularly I'm quite impulsive. I'm quite a fast-paced person. Mm. So there's definitely times when I'm thinking, I wish this would move a little bit quicker, but I don't think it's always for the best.
And presumably there's quite a lot of stuff that just falls by the wayside that just doesn't really ever even get to production.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's loads of things. And you know, I'll work on a pitch document and I'm like, this is amazing. This is going to be the best documentary ever. It's going to turn into a 6-part series. And then you sort of speak to an exec or you speak to a commissioner and you realise that actually you haven't really thought about this angle and that's why it's not going to get commissioned, or someone else is already making a similar documentary. So I think you have to get used to getting knocked back quite a lot because
it's kind of more likely that it's not going to get commissioned than it is. So you're having to be like, yeah, quite kind of self-confident and brazen, but knowing it might not work out.
Yeah, and it's definitely not like a personal thing. I think it's just sometimes there's similar ideas. Sometimes they can't really see how it's going to work. Sometimes it's just not the right story for right now.
Mm. What advice would you give people wanting to do what you've done? So going down kind of documentaries, media, investigative journalism, any advice for kind of young women thinking about doing that?
So I think the main advice that I always give is the best way to get into it is to have a story. So I think it's all well and good saying, oh, I'd like to present documentaries or I'd like to get into this. But if you can think about an area or a subject and you can go out and you can get yourself some access and you can say, I think this is a really amazing story and I've worked on getting this access to these contributors, and then you take that to a production company, then you're already a few steps ahead of people who are just sort of thinking about getting into the area. And I think, I mean, that's how I ended up falling into it. I had a story that I'd written about for Vice, and this production company got in contact with me and asked if I wanted to be a contributor on a documentary. And I was like, no, thank you. I don't want to be on TV. And then a year later, they came back and were like, oh, we don't have to talk about your experience, but would you be interested in reporting on other people's experiences?
What subject matter was that one?
So it was about catfishing. Mm-hmm. Cut a very long story short, when I was about 14, 15, these fake profiles were started of me and all my friends. And there was about 80 of them, and they went on for about 10 years. Wow. It was absolutely mad. People would actually recognise us in public. We were in Malia, and these guys came up to us and they were like, oh, I know who you are. Like, hey, Ellie, how you doing? Sort of thought, wow, they'd been speaking to
so
me for
scary.
A year. Yeah, it was mad. So this company got in contact and asked if I fancied being in a documentary. And we had lots of meetings over the course of a year, and I ended up meeting the BBC. And that actually never got commissioned. But in the meantime, I'd built up relationships and I'd met the commissioner, and I'd done a bit of undercover work. And so the BBC and this production company were like, oh, well, what about an undercover series idea? And then we pitched Rent for Sex and The Botox Bust and a few others, and they were the two that got commissioned.
Amazing. So, yeah, so I suppose it's having the idea and then it's networking, going out and meeting people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think putting yourself out there, you know, if you can, and also once you've had the opportunity to meet people, and once you have those connections, then follow up. I'm constantly chasing people up, sending emails, asking to go meet for a coffee again, because I just think that you know, no one owes you a job. You've got to graft a bit.
It's that freelance hustle, isn't it?
It is. It's such a hustle.
What do you think about, like, I feel like people are often saying, like, if you want to be a presenter or you want to be on the front of documentaries or TV, you need to go off and do your own YouTube channel and you need to create your own content. What do you think about that?
I don't think you have to do that. I mean, I'd never been in front of a camera before this documentary got commissioned. I think I did one sort of 5-minute video of me on my laptop talking about, I think I must have been talking about the catfish story, and then I suddenly was on TV, and I remember thinking, like, this guy is mad. Why is he so sure that I can do this job? I have no idea if I'm going to be any good. I don't think that that's the only way to do it, but I think that it's really hard. People always ask me that, like, you know, how do you get into it? And I just, for me, it was a lot of being in the right place at the right time and then working hard. So I don't think there is one set answer. I think just if you've got an idea and you think you can make it into something, there's no harm doing a YouTube channel. There's no harm trying to get other presenting jobs or other things that get you in front of a camera. Just for experience, I suppose, more than anything. But yeah, I don't think it's a necessity.
Are you no longer camera shy now?
No, I still hate having my photo taken so much.
Do you?
Yeah, I really do. And whenever we're on a shoot and we have to try and get some press shots, I'm always really grumpy about it for a while. So I'm just like, I never look good. I don't know what face to put. I look really awkward. But I think that's, I'm getting better.
Yeah.
And I'm much more used to having a camera filming me now than I was. I think when I first ever did it, I was, because I had no experience and no one had told me how to do it, I was really trying to be a presenter. So I was speaking in this sort of unnatural way and being quite, I remember the first interview I did, I think, was terrible because I just didn't know how to do it. And I'd been sent a script and I was really trying to remember the questions and it was really stiff. And then the director I was working with, who's a really good friend of mine now, I remember her saying to me, you know, you just have to forget about what you think a presenter is. Forget about how you think you need to ask these questions. Just be yourself. Do an interview like you were doing it over the phone or face to face without a camera here, and speak to me like I'm your mate. And I think that's definitely helped me to become more natural, more confident.
Yeah. Well, when you look at the kind of big, like, documentary makers, people like Louis Theroux, when you watch them, there's not so much of a real presenting style. It's just kind of him and he's just talking. And I think that's what makes people relaxed.
Yeah.
And gives you, like, the best possible content out of it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's, yeah. I was so nervous. I just didn't know what I was doing. I was like imposter syndrome to the max. I was like, I can't believe that I'm here.
Well, it sounds like you had good people around you, which makes a big difference.
Yeah, definitely.
With the Ellie Undercover series and with Rent for Sex, can you tell me a little bit about, like, the experience of making that documentary and kind of what impact it had on you as well?
Yeah. So that was really intense. And so all the documentaries that I make, I work as either a researcher or now I'm an assistant producer on all of them. And I've always said I want to be a big part of the production team. I don't want to just sort of come in and present it. If I was going to go into TV, I really wanted to actually get to grips with the journalism as well. So I worked on those. Must have been about 6 months, I think, in total, working on the two programmes, Rent for Sex and The Botox Bust. And it was really, really intense, especially because I had all these burner phones and I was looking after them. So in the middle of the night, my phone would be going off and it'd be sort of a landlord who was texting me that I'd contacted earlier in the day. And it's really hard to switch off from, and I couldn't really switch off from it because I was monitoring that at all times. But it does definitely take over your life. And I think at that point, especially because it's my first one, I wasn't really sure how to balance my home life and my work life, and it became quite all-consuming.
I can imagine. I imagine it had quite a strong effect on your personal life as well.
Yeah, but it was also really exciting and I loved it. So I think that, yeah, I wouldn't have changed anything.
What were some of the biggest kind of breakthroughs or discoveries you had in those two shows?
So Rent for Sex, I think, what was our biggest breakthrough on that? I think, to be honest, it was the scale of it. So we knew that it was happening quite a lot, and we'd done all of our research in order to warrant an undercover investigation. And then one of the things that we needed, in order to go and see one of these landlords and film with them undercover, we needed evidence that they'd already had someone to stay in the past. And when that was put as a sort of threshold that we had to meet, I remember thinking, this might be quite difficult. I wonder how many of them are actually just chancing it and how many have done this before. And the sheer numbers of people who had actively had people to stay before was really shocking, and I think that's when I really realised how big of an issue this was.
It was really like a story here.
Yeah, exactly. And with Botox, it was, so we'd been looking for, that was actually commissioned first. We'd been working on that one for ages, and we knew that there were these remote prescribers who were illegally prescribing Botox to beauticians across the country, and we really struggled to find any names. And we knew there was someone, and we felt like we were so close to it through this investigation, but we just couldn't get that breakthrough in terms of finding a name. And then right towards the end of our investigation, we finally got this doctor's name. And we were trying to set up an interview with him, or trying to find some kind of environment where I could naturally meet him and
his local Starbucks.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was more like see if he had a doctor's surgery, or see if he had a website where he said, you know, I can be a prescriber, and there was nothing. And then eventually we were going to send him a letter saying, okay, well, these are the allegations we have against him anyway. So we were going to send him a letter and say, what do you have to say about this? I was about to send this letter, and we had to find his address to send it. And while I was looking for the address, I realised that his house was on Airbnb. And so I just went over to my exec and I was like, I could just stay there and start talking about Botox. And he sort of looked at me and was like, this is an absolutely mad idea. And then we ran it all past the lawyers and were like, yeah, okay, well, maybe we should just book in, and then you can have that face-to-face meeting. And then that ended up being the biggest breakthrough of the investigation, because he explained how much he was doing, how he was doing it, and it just took the investigation to the next
level.
And
this was all undercover?
Yeah.
You must have been. I mean, how did you feel?
Yeah, I think I was scared then.
Were you nervous?
I was nervous. I think it was... it was more because everything had been hinging on this interview. We'd really, really been working so hard to try and get here. And I just remember sort of walking to his house. And there's one bit in the film where I'm chatting to Chloe, my director, who was also there with me. And I sound almost hysterical. I'm like, he might not even be in. This could be a complete waste of time. And my voice is really high-pitched throughout the whole thing, because I think I was just so nervous about getting found out or doing something wrong. So yeah, that was definitely one of the most nerve-wracking shoots.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Today's podcast is brought to you in partnership with Tide, the UK's fastest growing business current account provider. Feel confident in your first steps as a founder with smart financial tools and 24/7 in-app support. With easy invoicing and accounting integrations, Tide is an alternative to traditional banks for small businesses like yours. Spend less time on admin and more time on growing your business. Tide are also committed to helping women in business and are offering our listeners £50 when you open a Tide account and deposit £50. Just visit www.tide.co/shestartedit to get started. If you're feeling inspired by this week's episode and are thinking of starting your own business, why not come along to the next She Started It Live in London? Taking place on the 13th and 14th of March 2020 at Crypt on the Green in Farringdon, this two-day flagship festival will give you all the advice and inspiration you need to supercharge your career with over 75 incredible speakers. Book on Eventbrite now by searching for She Started It Live and use the code SHESTARTEDIT10 for 10% off. Do you ever worry about your own kind of personal security with doing work like this?
Definitely not as much as my mum does.
Yeah, I can imagine. I feel like my mum would be like, no, absolutely not.
Every time I'm like, mum, I'm doing another undercover, she's like, oh, yeah. Can't you just do something else? No, I don't think so. I think the most that I've ever felt scared for my personal safety would probably have been the landlords with Rent for Sex. But I think when you watch it, you think it's just me on my own going off to meet people. Mm. But I've always got a team around me. You know, there'll be a producer very nearby who's listening in on the microphone, or my director will be just outside. And there's always a contingency plan to get out.
Mm.
So
I'd like to see a documentary of you making a documentary.
Behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes, I would.
I'll pitch it.
Thank you. I'd be fascinated, honestly, I would. And you also fronted a documentary about Ireland's abortion referendum. Can you describe that and also how you felt when there was the yes vote?
What was really difficult about making that film was I really had to put myself in someone else's shoes. Going into that, I think growing up in the UK, having access to abortions if I ever needed it, I've just never really considered a pro-life argument, and I couldn't really understand it. And because there was a vote and lots of people felt strongly on either side, I really had to go into that and try and understand a point of view that I'd never thought about before. So that was a real challenge for me, and it was a sort of new step in making documentaries. And I think that was the biggest challenge that I faced. But also, it was really good for me because I did actually think about other people's point of views. And I think I really learned how to go into something and not be quite as biased and not be quite as informed by my own opinion. Mm. I definitely still was glad for the result at the end, and it was a sort of amazing feeling.
Did you feel kind of personally connected to that result because of the documentary?
Yeah, but then weirdly, I felt really sorry for Gavin, who was this boy that we'd spent quite a lot of time interviewing. And, you know, he was really sweet, and he just genuinely believed in a pro-life argument. And it came from his own experience of his mum wanting to have an abortion and then not going through with it. And so for him, it was so connected with his own sense of self-worth and his own sense of being deserving of a life. And it's difficult to argue with that when someone has such a strong personal connection to something and they really believe in an argument, then It was sad to see him on the day.
Mm. Yeah, it must be very, very conflicting, I imagine.
Yeah.
I suppose also you have access to another side of the coin that most people don't. Most people don't even really engage with that side of the argument and don't hear it. So to go so deeply onto another side, I can imagine that's quite conflicting as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it teaches you a lot just in general life. I think there's such a... People are so ready to just shut down anyone that disagrees with them or has a different opinion without actually listening and thinking about it. And I think this job's taught me so much just to be a bit more open and trying to understand other people's point of views, because I'm not right all the time.
And also other cultural references. I think we so often only kind of see things from our point of what we grew up with and what we understand.
Yeah, exactly.
And opening ourselves up to more understanding of other people's cultural references. You also did a documentary about Instagram and the dark side of social.
Yeah, multi-level marketing is that the one?
Yeah. Fascinating. My friend works for Arbonne.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. And whenever I go over there, she's like, oh, I just got a white Mercedes. And she's like, tries to rope me into becoming an Arbonne salesperson.
Everyone knows someone who's trying to rope them into them.
Yeah. And I'm very, honestly, I'm very conflicted about it because she seems to make an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
And I can't really deny that. Like, I've seen her weekly food shop. I've seen the white car.
Yeah, dream.
Yeah, but what? She's worked seriously hard on it. So the only thing she's done it for 5 years. Like, she's apparently one of the top people in the UK, but then I feel like everyone's one of the top people in the UK. I don't know, but I am conflicted about it, and I'm interested to hear what that was like. And do you think that, you know, this stuff is all having quite a negative impact on us?
Yeah, so I felt so conflicted throughout the course of making that documentary, because on one minute I'd be like, okay, no, this is really, really wrong, it's really, really exploitative. And then, you know, you'd see someone like that and I was like, oh, but maybe it's not so bad. And I really, really wrestled with it for a long time. And the more we uncovered and the more that I spoke to people who'd really been impacted by these companies, the more I thought that there's definitely something wrong here. And the thing is, some people do make a huge amount of money, but lots of people don't make anything at all. And it's not even just not making money, it's spending their own money.
That's the thing, it's like investing to build the website and own your own business and
exactly
everything. It kind of annoys me, like, as someone who owns their own business and genuinely feels like an entrepreneur, I think it does kind of annoy me the way it's banded around that they run their own business. You're like, it's not quite running your own business.
No.
Like, you'd have to pay to run your own business, so that from the off feels really dodgy to me.
Yeah, no, exactly. And for me, the key thing that I learned from that investigation was just there needs to be more transparency. It's so, so elusive. The compensation plans are so confusing. I feel like it is very misleading. The compensation plans are misleading. It's made to sound like it's very easy. And you're constantly fed this message that if you just work hard enough, if you really push yourself, you can do it. You can have the white Mercedes. You can have all the money. You can get to the top of your game. But the fact is, not everyone can. Not everyone's good at sales. Mm. Not everyone knows enough people. Not everyone lives in an area where lots of people want to buy their makeup products. And that's just facts. Mm. And that's what's misleading. You're told you can do it when the reality is you might not be able to.
Not everyone can. I think it also can, I imagine, put a huge amount of pressure on your personal relationships.
Because we're massively.
Like, if I can imagine, if I'm going for dinner with my best friend and I'm like, ooh, would you like to try a new lipstick? I imagine that is really strange and, I don't know, quite jarring.
Definitely. A lot of people said that their personal relationships were so negatively impacted by working for one of these companies because everyone's a target. Mm. You've constantly got to recruit. And if you're not making any money, you know that the way that you can actually make a success of this is to recruit a team. So if you want to make a success, you have to go out, you have to try and recruit your mum, your friend, the person in the shop that you just saw. Mm. And that it's really difficult. And I think as well, you're expected to spend so much time on it and it's all on your phone. So it's very antisocial and it can have a huge impact on your personal relationships with your family, your husband.
What do you think will happen to this industry? Do you think there is going to be more transparency?
I hope so. I really hope so. At the moment, it seems to exist in this grey area, really. It's a bit of a loophole where we try to speak to all these different regulatory bodies to say, you know, do you have anything to say? What can people do? And they didn't really know because there weren't any real set laws on it. There's laws on pyramid selling, but this isn't quite pyramid selling.
Yeah, it's multi-level, isn't it?
Yeah. There's some people who argue that it is pyramid selling, but it doesn't fit that area in the law. It exists in this sort of grey area in the law where it's not pyramid selling, but there definitely is some elements of exploitation and targeting vulnerable people, but there's not really any laws to protect people from it. So I hope that maybe the government will step in and try and enforce some laws where the companies have to be more transparent and have to really warn people about the likelihood of success before they sign up. Whether that will happen, I'm not sure.
Do you worry that social media as a whole has made young people a lot more vulnerable?
Yeah, I think that social media is making young people much more vulnerable. I think that the scam is evolving in a way where there's more and more things that are targeting young people on social media, and whether that's financial, whether that's sort of a romance scam, there's all these different ways that people can get caught out. And I think that a lot of that is happening on social media, and that's really dangerous.
Yeah. And if you just look at all the detox stuff, it's like all these products that still you're being billed as like, this is going to make you lose X amount of weight.
Yeah.
And they're really unhealthy, and it's quite scary. And I it's amazing that it's still so unregulated.
So unregulated. It's really hard to tell as well what's legit and what's not. I mean, I am the world's biggest consumer. Honestly, I'm Instagram's dream. I see one influencer with a teeth whitening thing and I'm like, oh, maybe I should get that. But I have to really do my research and think like, hey, right, is this actually any good? Is it going to do what it says? And most of the time, once you've done a bit of research into it, it's not.
It's also terrifying, you know, all the studies that have shown that young people are getting into debt so much younger because of things like Instagram, because it's the ease with which you can just swipe up and buy. That, like, yeah, that speed is terrifying.
Yeah, that's an area that I'm really interested in, actually, because it just feels like money's... Because you don't have cash anymore, money's not quite money. It's all just sort of something that you do over PayPal, or you send it over your phone. You can do it on Instagram, and it's so easy. Now you can just sort of tap your thumbprint on and then you spent money. And more people are getting into debt. And I think that with buy now, pay later things as well, it's just quite hard to keep on top of.
It's crazy. Like with the Klarna stuff, you can literally go on to Topshop and it'll be like an item that's like 15 quid and you can do it in installments, which is so mad. Like it's not even high ticket items, literally everything.
Everything.
You can Klarna, which is, it's scary because it makes you think you can basically buy anything and you think, oh, I'll just pay like 3 quid a month and then I will have paid off that backpack. And it's just not a good mentality to get into with money.
No, exactly. It's really dangerous, and I think that the issue is there's lots of these big companies and lots of people that are profiting out of that, but at what expense? I think that more and more people are struggling financially and are getting themselves into debt.
There's also a flip side of it, I think, where people also see other people's work lives on social media and think that they don't work like the whole time but make loads of money, like the multi-level marketing thing, or being an influencer, or being freelance. I think it's all quite glossy on social. So there's this like weird dichotomy where we want to spend loads of money but we also don't really want to work that hard anymore either, and I'm not really sure where we're at with any of that.
It's so true.
I think the 9-to-5 has been really demonized now. People don't want to put that, like, you know, those hours in. They want to make money quite quickly.
And it's weird because I feel like there is this growing sense that having a 9-to-5 is bad in some way. Having a 9-to-5 is a good thing to do. You know, great if you want to start your own business, if you want to be freelance. I'm glad that it's not the only way that we think of work now. But also, I don't think we should demonize it. You know, some people...
I think for mental health, like, a lot of people wouldn't be good at freelance. Like, it's really stressful. There's
really
loads
hard.
Of stuff that no one really tells you about, like how you sort out your own pension, like you don't get holiday leave,
taxes.
Like taxes, like literally taxes,
so
all of it. And it's really stressful, and it's also quite unstable at times, and it's hard to financially plan, and that doesn't suit everyone and doesn't suit everyone's mental health. So I agree. I think we have really glamorized the freelance life, and I'm here to tell you that it's
really not that glamorous.
It's really, like, very unglamorous when you were like at the end of the tax year with like two massive boxes of receipts and you were like, what is my life?
How do I do this?
I just send them all to my accountant with a little post-it note being like, sorry.
Please help.
Haven't itemized them. I'd also say, I think, like, what freaks me out sometimes is like the connectedness of it all. So you like go and watch Love Island, you see them wearing outfits, then you like go on your phone and the same outfits are advertised, and I get kind of freaked out by the nature of all, like, we all know that our phones are listening to our conversations and doing that for targeting ads, but it's
so
kind
scary.
Of freaky, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You know,
we
you'll talk about a pair
day.
Of shoes and then you see them on Instagram, like, you know, advertised.
Yeah. I feel like you feel constantly just bombarded by advertising and opportunities to spend and it's quite hard to say no sometimes, you know, and I think that, like we said, the ease with which you can just tap your thumbprint on a phone and buy something, I think it's just dangerous. But I don't really see there being an end to that, so
no.
I don't know what the solution is.
Here's a question. If your like card was like in your thumb, so you had like contactless payments through your thumb, would you do it? So you were like your debit card.
That's so weird. Probably.
Yeah, I know,
me
too.
I'd do anything for an easy life.
So you'd have to lose it. I think that's
so
the future.
True.
I think they're going to put a little chip in you.
Yeah, I feel like one of those old people now that's just like, oh God, technology.
Well, I went to the Amazon shop in San Jose, and when you go in, it syncs with your phone, so you get logged into your Amazon account. So then you can walk out; you don't have to go to a checkout, and whatever you take with you, it goes off your account.
That is insane.
It's quite mad, isn't it?
That's so mad. Yeah,
I went into the future. I know, it's all too easy. It's far too easy. So Ellie, what's next for you? What's your ambitions? What are you working on?
I've got a new BBC Three documentary out on sexual assault in police custody in the US, following the case of an 18-year-old girl who says that she was raped by two police officers in New York, and then looking at other cases across the country. Also working on a new documentary for BBC Three, which I can't say a huge amount about at the moment, but that's ongoing. And yeah, and then just sort of bits and bobs here and there. I still keep up with writing, done a few bits of reporting for The One Show, so yeah, it's cool.
Amazing. Well, congratulations on everything. I'm very excited to see all the stuff that you do in the future, and thank you for all your advice and coming on the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate and review so more people can find the show. Until next time, keep dreaming and achieving.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.